was relapsums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 141 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. In Somerville, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from San Francisco, California is Andrew Brokus. How are you, Andrew?
I'm doing well. How are you, Nate?
Fantastic. Fantastic. Getting into fall here. It's football season, which means that that it's still baseball season for me, which is what I really care about. And I'm back in town from Wisconsin. I had a very nice trip there, and I'm happy to also to be back home and back thinking about poker more.
Well, welcome home, and that's right. We should apologize to people for missing an episode last week, just between Nate being out of town and also with WCOOP going on right now. Even though I'm not actually playing yet, by the time you hear this, I should be in Montreal and playing some WCOOP, but just with other people. It's just a little harder to line up guests this time of year. A lot of the poker world is playing a lot of online poker right now.
Yeah. Andrew's being nice. I just took a vacation. That's why there wasn't an episode. It's all my fault.
No, that's only partially true. If we'd had a really good guest lined up, I would have, bullied through myself. But I didn't think people needed to hear a solo episode from me that badly.
That makes sense. And you're off to Montreal soon, right?
Yes. As much as I like Vancouver well enough, but it's not really that, even from San Francisco, it's not really that inconvenient for me to go to Montreal because I do have family and other people to visit on the East Coast, so I can get some other things done while I'm on the other side of the country. And the setup in Montreal is just much nicer, at least for me as a visitor, and maybe for any visitor without a vehicle. Vancouver I found to be a somewhat tricky city to get around, and Montreal, on the other hand, they have a great bike share program, which is, it's not like you can just like kind of take one and use it when you need it and then bring it back, which is a particularly good thing to kind of do around poker. It's the sort of thing that I can just go around the city for a little bit for an hour or two in the morning before I start playing a poker tournament later in the day or something like that. It's just it's very well suited to my needs, I feel like, and I'm kind of excited to be going back to Montreal, even though it's no longer the most convenient Canadian thing.
Right. Well, enjoy. And you're playing a full schedule when you're there? Like, will you be playing the WCOOP tournament every day? Or
I do think so. I'm only going to be there for like the last 10 days or so of the series. And I probably am not going to take any days off in there. If I'm going for 3+ weeks, I'm usually going to try to take like one day a week off. But I think for 10 days, I'll probably just play, well, hopefully every day. Whether I play that the Monday after the main event, it will depend on how things go on that Sunday.
All right. Well, good luck, and may you play many interesting hands that we can talk about on air.
Interesting can mean a lot of different things, but yeah, I guess from podcast equity, it doesn't really matter how I do in them. But to some extent, I might prefer just nothing but trivial decisions for 10 days.
Yeah, or just run great and win a few of them. That would be nice too.
Yeah, that would still be fun to talk about, right?
Yeah,
it was
absolutely.
Like, well, and then someone else went all in, and I had aces again, so I decided to call him, and then.
Yeah, that's real tricky.
Well, how about you? Did you play any poker while you were in the Midwest?
I did not. I was tempted to stop by Pottawatomie. There's some place in Milwaukee, but eventually I decided to. Just make it a pure family/recreation trip, and did not play any cards. So the New Hampshire, my New Hampshire poker escapades are still the most recent poker I've had.
And you're still enjoying yourself up there?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would get in while it's hot if I were near New Hampshire. It's an interesting place. There's a charity poker scene there, and there's a bunch of rooms. There's a place in Salem where you can play 2-4 no limit. Subject to a few constraints, but for the most part, it's just deep stacked 2-4 no limit. And I played there. I liked a lot of the people that I met there. There are a lot of tough players there, but not all the players who are there are tough. That said, an uncapped 2-5 game, and I worry about the health of the game. How about that? So if it's a choice between going now or later, I might suggest going soon and enjoying it while you can.
Wait, so when you say worry about the health, you mean just it's the sort of game where weaker players can go broke?
Yeah, so it's uncapped, and for one thing, so you get a lot of people just buying in for $2,000 to $5,000 in a 2-4 game. So there's not a lot of room to hide, and so between that, I would say the atmosphere is sometimes friendly, but sometimes not all that friendly, and I worry both about the experience that a recreational player would have in the game, and just the negative win rate that a recreational player would have in the game. There's really no place to hide, and that's not to say that everybody who buys in from for $2,000 is an expert. Decidedly not, but they're all thinking really hard about how to win big pots against people who are playing with 1,000 or 2,000 in front of them who are not very good. So there's that, and in general, and I don't mean to disparage any of the staff, and indeed a lot of the staff there is very good. That said, you really have to get a lot of things right to have a good, sustainable poker room. And we'll see if they get all those things right between the lack of a cap and just and I'm speaking from ignorance here. I haven't studied the room carefully, but
that could be the name of this podcast.
Speaking from ignorance. Yeah. There's a lot of security things you have to get right. There's a lot of procedural things you have to get right. There's some promotional things that you have to get right. I quite enjoy the atmosphere in the Salem Card Room. It really just is. It's an old racetrack where there aren't any races anymore, and so it's just it's a bit like somebody took like a basketball court at a YMCA and put a bunch of poker tables in there, and that is just fine with me. It's great, but we'll see if recreational players like it, and I hope that the good staff they have there does very well. I'd like to see it succeed, but getting a poker room to succeed is an uphill battle, especially when some of the preliminary decisions have been made the way they have been. So I would recommend getting it while the getting's good if if you're planning a trip there.
You know, the other thing that's a factor that, it doesn't always occur to me because it's kind of irrational, but I know it is a concern for a lot of recreational players when they allow those kind of uncapped buy-ins, is that people feel intimidated to buy in for what would generally Absolutely. Be like a normal amount, like even a lot, like $1,000 at a 2-5 game, which is like more than many places would let you buy in for in their 2-5 game anyway. Yeah. But just the idea that other people are buying in for $3,000 or $4,000, I think it's a very prevalent belief that that somehow puts you at a disadvantage buying in for only $1,000, that you're going to get bullied or something like that. And although that actually quite the opposite is true, and the player with the shorter stack generally has an advantage in that situation. But yeah, my understanding is it's very intimidating for a certain type of player.
Yeah, absolutely. That said, I expect to get a lot more practice at playing 500 and 1,000 big blinds deep. I played some fun hands where the depth of the stacks really, really came into play. And some of them I've talked about on Twitter. Some of them we might talk about in future episodes. But some of my favorite strategic discussions that we've had on air recently have had to do with a very deep stacked play. I really enjoy it. And everything changes, and it's a lot of fun, and it's
it's great fun.
Yeah,
it's great fun.
One of the really good advice that I remember from the early days of poker is get your friends together. Even if you like to drink beer when you play, don't drink too much. And let's say you're a 10-20 no limit expert, get everybody together, play 50 cent a dollar, but 2,000 big blinds deep, and really try to win and see how that goes. It's a great exercise. I'd recommend it to anyone. Play small stakes for you, but very, very deep, and do your best.
Yeah, I've done that with friends before, actually. We just played like a $50 game. I mean, this was many years ago, when I didn't have quite the advantage over my non-poker friend, or I had like a bunch of people who kind of, we used to play poker together a lot, and they were like pretty serious non-professional players, but the gulf between me and them in the last 5 to 10 years has definitely increased quite a bit. But at that time, it was not unreasonable for us to get together and play like a $50 game, and you could just buy in for $500 or $1,000 or something, and that was like enough that even for me and certainly for them, like you would feel the sting if you lost your full stack. But it wasn't like devastating for them. Yeah. So yeah, that was, yeah, I agree. That's good fun.
Yeah.
We even sometimes the game that I play in now at Lucky Chances is technically a 5-10 game with a $2,500 cap. But, there's, I would say maybe even close to half of the hands that we play, we end up playing with a straddle. Like we very frequently play with a, you know, quote, voluntary straddle.
Sure.
And I sometimes kind of resist that, even though, I mean, to some, in some sense, it's, you know, kind of in my interest to raise the stakes, but I sometimes feel like I might have a bigger edge, or at least like I'm not losing very much, and it's a lot more fun to play the deeper 5-10 game rather than to play a 5-10-20 where everybody only has, you know, roughly 100 big blinds or not much more than 100 big blinds. I think that sometimes the kinds of mistakes that, especially if it's a lot of like okay players. So, I mean, sometimes there are people who just like their preflop ranges are just way, way off. And I'm sure you all know what kind of thing I'm talking about. And so, I mean, with that sort of player in the game, yeah, like 5-10-20 is welcome. But you know, sometimes when I'm playing against people who are kind of experienced, like live players who have, you know, like their preflop fundamentals are not terrible, I might actually rather be playing the deeper 5-10 game against them, or it like I said, it's at least, you know, more interesting, and I don't think I'm giving up that much by not playing 5-10-20.
Sure. So one thing that happens against that type of player a lot is that, let's say on the turn they make a bet and they mark themselves with top pair, second kicker, yes, or a hand in that range. And if you're playing 100 big blinds deep, there's only so much you can do sometimes. If you're playing 500 big blinds deep, you can really put the screws to them. And is that the sort of thing you have in mind?
That is precisely the sort of thing I have. When I say great fun, that mostly involves putting the screws to people.
Yeah,
that's my idea of fun.
I mean, of course, sometimes you have it, right? That's the problem. Well,
sure. That's where the screws come in. If you just never have it, it's not so hard to play against you.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's not so hard. Sometimes people have a hard time anyway, even if you never have it. It's precisely that. It's a bit like playing cash game poker instead of mid-stage tournament poker, where a lot of times in a tournament you say, okay, I know precisely what this person has. The problem is that I can't beat it and he won't fold it. So then you get to a cash game and you can get a little trickier. As the stacks get deeper, you can even get more creative. So good.
Well, we don't have a guest for you this week, but what that means is that there will be even more great strategy content from Nate and myself, and that strategy content is brought to you by Tournament Poker Edge. With the World Championship of Online Poker already in full swing, if you're playing, you certainly want to get on TPE and watch some of the great videos that are out there from previous WCOOP events, whether you're watching my videos, whether you're watching videos from former podcast guest Mike Goleafs Go A Leah, who final tabled the WCOOP, and you can see the main event of the WCOOP, you can see his run on there. So lots of great WCOOP videos to help you prepare. And you can also expect that if you get on TPE now, you will have access to whatever videos I make after my own play in the WCOOP, and I'm sure some of the other pros will be producing some WCOOP videos as well. So whether or not you are playing the WCOOP or just interested in spectating, this is a great time to sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com. Our first, situation, and this is one of those procedural questions that I think Nate in particular is very good at handling, and I'm always interested, Nate, in hearing your take on this, is coming to us from Dan. Dan was playing 2-5 in Las Vegas. Stacks were $800 to $1,500. Effective stacks in this hand are $900. Player one in early position, and I'll just point out now for people who are listening, remembering the details of this hand is not super important. We're mostly just interested in in what happens at the end, and is it from a procedural point of view. So Player one in early position raises over a limp to $25. Player two next to act re-raises to 50. Player one calls, and they go heads up to the flop, which is queen 9-5 all hearts. The flop goes check, check. The turn, player one is the eight of spades. Player one bets 60. Player two calls. Pot is 220. River is the seven of clubs. Now here's where we want to pay attention to the action. Player one thinks for a bit, takes five green chips in his hand, so that's $125 in chips, and reaches forwards towards the betting line. Player two says call and slams down pocket aces without the ace of hearts. Player one does not move, holds onto his chips, and says check. So basically, he makes a motion forward as though he were planning to bet. Player two says call and tables his hand without actually giving player one a chance to complete the or to let go of the chips or to announce exactly how much he plans to bet. And now player one is trying to avoid betting at all once he sees player two's hand. So the floor is called. And Dan says, it's clear that player one intended to bet, most likely the $125 in his hand, although the rules of this poker room would have allowed him to bet another amount, so he'd be allowed to declare a different amount. Player two did not make any attempt to protect his hand. He's got some more specific questions, but I don't know, I guess I'm curious even at this point, Nate, what's your take on this situation?
Yeah, so a lot of things to say here. One is that there are a lot of cultural variations in this sort of game. In a lot of the places where I play, it's up to the floor's discretion. And indeed, I think a lot of what goes on in these situations should be largely discretionary. And the player would be ruled to have bet whatever he obviously intended to bet. And this is, so it's tricky. On the one hand, it's good to have very clear rules about these things and to follow those rules to the letter. On the other hand, a traditional view in poker, whether you think it's anarchic or whatever, it's traditional in a lot of places for the floor to have sort of the broad ability to overrule the letter of the law and to make whatever was clearly intended and clearly understood stand. And that's the sort of ultimate defense against angle shooters. Indeed, I think there's room actually for poker to be like a case study in the philosophy of law, because there are a lot of old school types who will say the rules of a poker room aren't there to define the rules of poker. They're there to teach people how to play, and they're there to sort of make it clear what activity you're engaged in a poker room. but they're not there to sort of dictate down to the smallest detail what the rulings are going to be. This is all relevant because, like, the culture around this varies from place to place, and in some places, especially where the poker culture is a little bit younger and where the players tend to be a little bit less sophisticated, there can be sort of very exact rules. Like, sometimes I've played in rooms where there's like a line on the table, and everybody who's a regular there understands that any chips that go over a line are a bet, and any chips that don't go over the line are not a bet. So I got myself into trouble because I remember picking up a stack of, you know, 25 red chips and taking them over the line and cutting out $50. And I think I had to bet the whole stack. And I wasn't trying to angle anybody. Sometimes people do that as like a power move. By the way, it's a common strong means weak tell if they do that. But I wasn't. I was just, you know, it's a common thing the poker players do. But in that room, everybody sort of understood that you bet everything that you put over the line and only what you put over the line. So if it's that kind of situation, then I think the correct ruling is different from, say, what it would be at the Bellagio, where, you know, the player base is a bit more sophisticated. And I think the ruling is going to more likely have to do with what was clearly intended and clearly understood and clearly communicated. So that's a long way of saying I don't know what the right ruling in this situation is. I think and moreover, different places have different rules around this, and different places have sort of different conventions about this. And I think both what the correct ruling according to the rules of the room is and the correct ruling as a matter of like poker ethics and poker justice is, that's going to vary place to place. I can think of a lot of rooms in which this would be a bet of 125 and a call. I can also think of some rooms where player A would get a chance to bet between one chip that he has in his hand, like he can bet sort of any subset of the chips he has in his hand in this situation, which makes sense if it's one of these rooms where people routinely and in a non-angle shooty way grab a lot of chips and bring them over the line and then cut them out. And when you think about it, like a convenient way to bet $300 is to pick up a bunch of green chips, then cut out three stacks of four, right? That's a very common thing. It's not an angle shoot. It's just what people do, and it keeps the game moving smoothly, right? Much more smoothly than, like, we've all played with inexperienced players who have to, like, you know, cut out the exact number of chips before they move them over the line. And that's fine, but it does slow up the game. So, yeah, it's a long way of saying it depends, but I really hope that neither player A nor player B gets a chance to angle here. Like, depending on the situation, you can imagine player A shooting an angle by artificially reducing his bet, and player B shooting an angle by trying to get player A to bet the full amount. Like, you could imagine player B thinking, oh, he's probably only going to bet $50, but he's got that whole handful of green chips. Maybe he'll be stuck to the full amount if I just say call. And you also see this sometimes, like in a no-limit game, if somebody's like cutting out chips in doing so with a slight forward motion. So let's say there's $100 in the pot and somebody picks up $300 and starts playing with those chips in front of his cards. You'll sometimes people say call and turn over the nuts just to try to get the ruling that everything that's in front of the cards plays. It's a long way of saying I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, the biggest issue I have here is that I think even without intentionally angling, the second player by instantly saying call, you know, assuming that we're in a room where, which it sounds like we are, where, you know, without player two doing anything, player one would not be required to bet the full amount that's in his hand and would perhaps even be allowed to bet more, which it sounds like might be the case from our correspondence with Dan, that, you know, he may be committed to. So I think that there's kind of two separate questions. One is, like, does the forward motion commit him to bet something? And two is, does it commit him to bet some specific amount? Does it put a cap on how much he can bet? You know, or is he allowed to come forward with five green chips and then say, you know, $1,000? You know, is that allowed? Because if that is permitted, then I think, like, intentionally or not, player two has taken a strategic option away from player one. Like, player two should not be able to force player one to bet some specific amount that player one has not committed to betting. And I think that, you know, in a room where coming forward with five green chips doesn't commit him to a specific amount, I don't see how a floor person could determine, like, oh, clearly he meant to bet X dollars. That seems like that couldn't possibly be the right solution. I mean, clearly it seems like player one should not be allowed to, if he was intending to bet, I think that it's somewhat, you know, scummy on his part to now try to say that he's not going to bet anything at all. It may seems like he's clearly kind of taking advantage of a situation. I do think this is, like, very sloppy on player two's part. I think the player who just, like, even assuming he wasn't trying to shoot an angle, which I'm willing to believe, I still think it's just very sloppy for him to, like, turn his hand over before player one has, like, done or declared anything.
Absolutely.
So I don't feel too bad for whatever outcome he ends up getting. I think he essentially just, like, brought it on himself through sloppy play.
Absolutely. And so something that I'll do in games sometimes is, even when I put chips across the line and release them, and then the other person says call, I will sometimes say, like, do you see the black chips? Like, you know that's what the bet was, right? Like, I mean, because there's, in a lot of places, there's, like, a gross misunderstanding clause, which makes sense. And if it's well established that there was a gross misunderstanding of the bet amount, then the action can be revised. And this gets into thorny situations, but you know, in a lot of places, especially if intentionally or unintentionally a high denomination chip was concealed, then you know, even if you hear the word call, then the action's not done yet. And sometimes, you know, it's easy to hear the wrong thing, and in the absence of anything that a camera can see, Dealers don't hear things sometimes. Your opponents don't hear things sometimes. It's always best. This is part of protecting your hand. As I've said recently on air, protecting your hand is not just putting a chip on top of it so that it doesn't get mucked. Protecting your hand is also not turning it over too early at showdown, and you know, not giving it to the dealer before you've gotten the pot, etc. So this is a clear failure to protect a hand by player two.
Dan does ask a couple of specific questions, some of which I think we've addressed already. The first is, could player one, upon seeing player two's hand, have announced all in, or is the maximum bet the 125 in his hand? That seems like something that's going to pretty obviously vary from room to room, but it does seem to me in this situation that to the extent that there's any discretion that the floor person has, he should not allow player one to bet more than the 125. I don't know if I want to commit to that position.
I mean, you could imagine being the floor and asking the dealer, like, was it obvious that he wasn't going to say anything bigger? And, if it really wasn't, you could imagine ruling that the first player could bet anything up to the pot, maybe. You know, you could imagine, maybe that's not a perfect solution, but... if they're both playing.
Every time I like start to think of some like restriction on player one, it just seems unreasonable for player two to be allowed to impose that restriction on him by acting out of turn.
Yeah, that's right. But you know, punishments should also be proportional, and especially if it doesn't, like player two, you could imagine an error in something that player two does. Player two is going to lose some of his options too, and it also makes sense if player one can't, sort of fully exploit those. I mean, again, analogies with the law are useful. Like if I commit a crime, that usually gives the person I've aggrieved some rights over me, and usually in that case I also gain protections against that person, precisely because that person has gained sort of new rights and abilities with respect to me or my property. And I think that's reasonable.
That actually brings us to Dan's second question, which is, given that player two's action was out of turn, is he obligated to call the bet if the chips are released, given that the action was not complete on the bet when he said call? So now if player one, for instance, well, maybe it's even two separate questions. Like if player one bets the 125 in his hand, is player two obligated to call? And it's hard for me to imagine that he wouldn't be. But then the second question is, if player one declares all in, is player two going to be obligated to call that? And that seems like a pretty clear no to me, but I'd be curious to hear if you think I'm wrong about that.
No, I think if he says call and if he releases whatever is in his hand, I think he's obligated to call it, unless there's like a $5,000 chip that's close in color to a $25 chip or something that's in the stack. The all in case is much trickier. I would lean to saying no, unless maybe player two is a known angle shooter who's been warned about this in the past. In that case, I think the sort of reciprocal losing of abilities is, I think there's less of a case for that.
Now here's an interesting one. What should the ruling by the floor be, and what other action, if any, should the floor take? So I think we've already kind of talked about that first point, but and actually I guess I'll give the results at this point because it ends up being relevant to this question. Dan tells us the floor rules that player one is obligated to make a minimum bet, i.e. at least $5, since no amount was announced and action was not complete. Player one puts out $5 and folds. The floor issues a warning to player one that if he does that again, he will be asked to leave. And no warning was issued to player two. So do you think it's reasonable to give this player a sort of warning? And do you think that what player one did was ethical for him to kind of take advantage of the situation to bet presumably less than he was planning on betting?
I think since he wasn't able to complete his bet, that it's reasonable for... Yeah, I mean, I think $5 is, yeah, I think it's fine, especially if he legitimately had some, if he like legitimately felt that his bet wasn't complete, then I think that's fine. Like the other person got sloppy and he gained some information, and that's okay. I think it's right to warn him. I think that's exactly right. And I think the first thing that the floor should be doing here, besides sort of avoiding unfair results, is to keep people from thinking that they can shoot an angle. And I think it's really great that the floor gave player one a warning, even for following the rules that the floor had laid down for this hand. I think that's great. There was another question, right?
Yeah, well, is player one being unethical, and is there other action that the floor should take? So I guess the thing is, should they have, like, Dan seems a little bothered that that player two didn't get any sort of warning. I'm not sure what we mean by warning here. Like, I think he probably learned that he shouldn't do what he did again, and you know, he did suffer a penalty as a result, which is that he won less than he would have if he didn't. You know, should the floor say something to him like, you're going to be asked to leave if you do that again? That actually seems a little excessive to me, assuming that we think it was an honest mistake.
Yeah.
You know, what player one did here, betting the minimum amount, whether or not you think it's ethical, it wasn't a mistake. Like, he realized what the situation was, and he chose to take advantage of that to save himself some money. So I can understand the floor wanting to say to him, you know, we'd prefer that you didn't do that sort of thing here in the future, and people aren't going to want to play with you, and our room is not going to be popular if we allow people to do that sort of thing, and so we don't want you taking advantage of that kind of situation here again. It doesn't seem as obvious to me that, you know, player two needs to be you know, told he's going to be asked to leave as a result of what was presumably a mistake on his part.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think player two got a pretty good warning by being so at the mercy of player one. It might be nice to say, hey, by the way, you're opening yourself up to face a large bet if that happens, if in fact that's the case. But I think that ruling as he did, and also warning player one, I think that makes it clear that, you know, this is a room where, I mean, I would hope that makes it clear that it's a room where angling won't be tolerated, and that these sorts of shenanigans won't be successful. And I think that's enough. I don't think player two necessarily needs an explicit warning after that, especially because if player two gets involved in a sticky situation later, it'll be clear to everybody that he shouldn't be given the benefit of the doubt, right? So in a sense, I mean, this isn't like, it's not like a traffic, or what's it not like? Yeah, it's not like an official thing, or like at the World Series where when you get a warning, they like write it down in a book somewhere, or they keep track of it, right? Like, a warning really just is the warning, and I think player two's gotten a warning.
All right, well, thank you, Dan. Interesting question, definitely. The kind of thing I enjoy. Sorry, did you have more you wanted to say?
Yeah. I had one more thing. But let's thank Dan first. You were right.
No, I was going to say, it's the sort of thing I enjoy discussing with you, and I think it's a good thing for, you know, especially for more amateurish players among, or just less experienced players among our listeners, to kind of be aware of how these situations can be resolved, and in particular, you know, your responsibilities to protect your hand. I do really feel like, even though, you know, arguably player one did something that was a little bit angle shooty, I think the central problem here is player two, who opens himself up to this, and I think all kind of bad things can happen as a result of what player two did here. So even if it was unintentional, just be patient a second. Even if you're excited to have aces, you're excited to make your call or whatever, just, you make sure that the action is clear. There's a lot of good reasons not to do stuff instantly, and it's not only because stuff like this can arise. I think a lot of times you might actually make a better decision if you give yourself a second to think about it. But certainly you want to make sure that your opponent's action is complete before you act.
I agree. I was going to say, there's a fun little, it would be like a short answer question on a Poker 101 or maybe Poker 201 final exam, is ignoring the ethics and the etiquette of the situation. If player two exposes aces and commits himself to call whatever you bet, what's the right thing to do if you're player one? Assume that your range includes both some hands that beat aces and some hands that do not beat aces. Also assume that player two is a perfect computer, besides the fact that he's committed himself to call whatever you bet. Go. What's the answer?
Say again the situation. Just generally, like, what should you do, assuming your range consists of...
Yeah, so the effective stacks are five times the pot. You're player one, you're first to act. Player two exposes aces and commits himself to call whatever you bet. Your range has some hands that beat aces and some hands that do not beat aces. What's your play?
So you go all in with all the hands that beat aces, and then also with... you know, if you also are close enough to being a perfect computer that you can figure out the exact ratio, great. But at least some number of the hands that do not beat aces. And given that you have the opportunity to bet five times the pot, you can probably bet quite a few of the hands that do not beat aces for an all-in as well, and still avoid giving your opponent any kind of good option.
Full points to Andrew. I think the key point is that, at least from a theory point of view, the largest bet size you can make is the best one to make.
Yeah, this is like a straightforward, perfectly solvable toy game. When we know his hand exactly, and we know how our range stacks up against his.
Yeah, that's right. And your opponent will be calling 5 to win 11. So you want your range to be 6 value hands per 5 bluffs. Is that right? And go all in with every hand that can beat aces, and 5/6 as many bluffs.
We also have a follow-up to our previous strategy question from Zach. This was on episode 140. So I'll just remind people quickly the details of that hand. Again, the actual details are not super important. We discussed the hand itself on episode 140, if you're curious. This is more just a reminder, and then we're going to talk about the idea of bluffing in smaller stakes games generally. So the main villain in the pot opens for $12 in early position. This is a 1-2 underground game in New York. Effective stacks of $1,100, so quite a deep 1-2 game. The main villain opens for $12 in early position. A loose passive player who is weak tight post-flop calls on the cutoff. Hero calls on the button with 4-3 of clubs. The three of them see a queen 4 deuce with one club flop. Early position player bets 25, the loose passive player calls, and the hero calls. The turn is the 6 of clubs, so the board is now queen 4 deuce 6 with 2 clubs, and our hero holding 3-4 of clubs for bottom pair, a gutshot, and a flush draw. Early position bets $60 into 112, and our hero decides that this player almost always has king-queen, ace-queen, kings, aces or queens. Does not expect him really to double barrel bluff very often. The recreational player quickly folds. Our hero raises to 165, and the villain calls. The river, $442 in the pot, is the 9 of diamonds. Villain tanks for about a minute, and then our hero says he Hollywoods for 20 to 30 seconds, and then bets $330, and the villain snap calls him with king-queen for top pair. So here, he executed what you and I, Nate, thought was a pretty good bluff. I think, in fact, we were discussing what sort of odds we would want to be laid that that this was not a bluff, and I think I told you I wanted 4-1, if I recall correctly, and you told me you thought that was a pretty good line. Or sorry, not that it wasn't a bluff, but rather that we both thought there was a very good chance that the main villain was going to fold.
Yeah.
And so I said that I would take I would need to get 4-1 to bet that he did not fold, and you were reluctant to offer me that.
Yeah. We were also conditioning on the fact that he sent in the email. So
that's true.
Yeah, but. Yes, and I was reluctant. I was reluctant to offer those odds, and in fact, I didn't. So,
as it happens, the hero was called, and in his follow up, the villain said to him, "I figured you either had a set or air, and I just had a feeling you were light." So, in his follow up email, Zach said, "It was a weird hand for me because I think I told a convincing story for a set, especially given the game flow, and it made me wonder how valuable these rare, what seem like great bluffing moments in deep stacked poker, how valuable they are. My win rate at low stakes hold'em, primarily 2-5 with some 1-2 here and there, has really gone up in the last 6 months or so as I've started playing a bit tighter pre-flop and just taking fewer bluffing spots post-flop. But usually during a long session, I'll end up trying one bluff like this when it's warranted. Overall, it's gone well, but I can't decide if I'm being too results-oriented this time, or if due to my image, I should just eliminate trying to represent sets against obvious pairs, even when the opponents seem like winning regulars." And I think this is kind of a common sentiment among a lot of people, but smaller stakes players in particular, which is just sort of like bluffing doesn't really play a big role in their game. You know, maybe there's some continuation betting or occasional, you know, attempted preflop blind steals, but this sort of like represent a big hand in order to get my opponent to fold a hand that he clearly has some interest in. I think that's something that a lot of smaller stakes players, even winning smaller stakes players, don't often do. And I think it's correct to not often do it. For one thing, a lot of smaller stakes games tend to feature, you know, short stacks. Right? Nate and I talked at the beginning of the show about how much we enjoy playing 300 and 400 big blinds deep, because you really can put the screws the people who make clear that all they have is an overbear. And when you're playing a 1-2 game where a lot of people are buying in for $200 or less, people don't fold overpairs, and usually correctly they don't fold overpairs. So the idea of like bluffing somebody off of an overpair, I think some people get in their heads like, well, you should never try to bluff somebody off of an overpair. And that's true when stacks are shallow. It's rarely a good idea. However, when stacks are very deep, it's not necessarily true that you should never try to bluff someone off of an overpair. There are certain opponents who you should never try to bluff off an overpair, and you probably know who those people are. And they're probably the reason why you're playing in the game. But there are some pretty decent players in these games as well. And decent players just like don't routinely put 300, 400, 500, 600 big blinds into the pot with just one pair. And so as we were discussing in our previous example about shoving the river when we knew our opponent had aces, in these spots where you kind of have an idea of what your opponent's hand is and you know it's not the nuts and you don't know what he's going to do with it, kind of the best outcome that you can get is to play your very strong hands, all the hands that beat whatever you're pretty sure your opponent has, to play those kind of as fast, as hard as you can, and then also choose some good bluffing candidates and play those fast and hard as well. And if you don't know how your opponent is going to respond, that is the best strategy that you can use. I'm going to ask you to jump in here, Nick, because I feel like I'm starting to ramble a little bit.
No, that makes perfect sense. I agree with everything you've said. Also, once I played with somebody who was 600 big blinds deep, and whenever he had aces, kings, or queens pre-flop, would always raise to 25 instead of 15 or 20. That was really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, I agree. Bluff more. If you're listening, you should probably be bluffing more.
So, here's one thing that that I think is kind of interesting about this hand. And so I think there's a lot of people, and we did get at least one Twitter comment who was like, what, trying to run a big bluff in an underground New York game? What are you thinking? And I don't know. I mean, let's suppose here that our hero actually flopped a set. So he's got, we'll say, pocket fours. And he flops a set, and he decides to take exactly this line with it, which I think is a perfectly fine line to take with the set. Or he decides to do essentially this, which is like call the flop, make a sort of small raise on the turn, and then bet a somewhat large but not like huge amount on the river, you know, 75% pot on the river. You might ask yourself, why is that all that you're betting with a set? Why is it that if you have a set of fours and you're pretty sure that fours are good and you're pretty sure your opponent just has, you know, top pair or an overpair, and you have money behind, or you're not betting your full stack, your turn raise does not enable you to bet full stacks on the river unless you significantly overbet the pot on the river, and you choose not to overbet the pot on the river, you know, you could be putting more money into the pot with effectively the nuts, with a nut hand, a hand that you're pretty confident is good, and you're choosing not to do that. Why is it that you're choosing not to put your entire stack in there with a set? Presumably, it's because you think your opponent might not call the full stack if he just has top pair, which then opens up the question, well, then sounds like maybe you should have some sort of bluffing range against him, right? If you think that he's not going to put his entire stack in there when you have a set, then presumably you should have some bluffing range for putting your entire stack in there if you're pretty sure that he has top pair. What's more common is that you don't know whether he's going to put his entire stack in there with top pair or not. And again, like, and we did criticize Zach a little bit for this, that we're thinking, if anything, he might actually be able to make a larger raise on the turn and then a larger river bet. And I think that is how you would want to play a set as well. So very similar, actually, to the situation where on the river, our opponent's hand was clearly defined as aces. And we were talking about, you know, the best play would just be to go all in for 5x pot. Here, once again, once you're pretty confident that you have your opponent nailed down on top pair, and it's a little bit significant that that the hero is putting queens in, you know, for top set into the villain's range, but nevertheless, like, the vast majority of villain's range is going to be top pair hands, such that if he can get the player to fold everything except top set, it'll be a very profitable bluff. So, you know, when you find yourself in that kind of situation, once again, the way to make the most of it is to take all of your hands that beat the majority of the hands that you're thinking your opponent, you know, may stack off with, but it is not guaranteed to stack off with. Find a way to get stacks in with those hands, and then take the same line with some of your bluffs. I definitely don't think it's true that you shouldn't try to bluff. I mean, you know, if nothing else, I think that it's good. It's good practice, and if it turns out you have just a ridiculously sticky opponent, then maybe don't. You know, like, there are certain players I might choose not to do it against, but I would have a reason for that. You know, I, I think a lot of people are under the impression that you have to have a read on somebody before you try to bluff them. And I think the opposite is true. I think that, you know, your default should be that you're going to have balanced ranges that consist of bluffs and value bets. And if you have some reason, either because of the particular opponent or just because of you know, their stack size or whatever, you have reason to think that they're not going to fold the kind of hand that you're trying to get them to fold, then you might, you know, choose not to have any bluffs in your range against that person. But I don't think that your default should be like, oh, I'm just never going to run a big bluff in this game, at least not when you find yourself deep stacked against another potentially good player. And I think one thing that might have happened as a result of our hero, you know, potentially being unbalanced here, and I think it's possible that our hero would not have played a set in exactly this way. He might have tried to put more money into the pot with a set or done the bet sizing a little bit. You know, I think kind of what happened here was he made a small raise on the turn because he sort of wanted his opponent to call him on the turn with a hand that was going to fold on the river. And then he made a big bet on the river because he wanted his opponent to fold. And when you're playing with good players, they're sometimes, even if he couldn't articulate it exactly like this, you know, remember what his opponent said to him. He said, I just had a feeling you were light. And I think sometimes good players, even if they can't put their finger on exactly why, they can pick up on these little sizing tell differences where maybe you would have raised bigger on the turn if you actually had a set, or you wouldn't have bet quite so much on the river if you actually had a set. And so he may have been able to sniff that out if you weren't actually balanced here. If you were thinking, well, since I want him to fold, I'll make a bigger bet size amount on the river. And on the turn, I've got a lot of outs, and I don't even necessarily want him to fold the turn because I know I'm going to bluff the river. So I'm just going to make a sort of small raise on the turn to you know, tell him I have a set, to let him think I have a set, but also price him in. And then on the river, I'll try to bomb it and get him out. And if that's a line that you're only taking with a bluff and you would have sized differently with a set, I wouldn't put it past an experienced live player to sniff out something like that. So I think there's even a chance that this kind of underlines the importance of balance as opposed to taking exploitive lines against pretty good players.
I agree. I have two small things to say. Thing number one is this idea that nobody folds over pairs, I think that's not true. And in fact, even a lot of the weaker players, like what the ones who are playing deep, what they're thinking is, aha, I'm going to beat an overpair, then get some sucker to stack off with just an overpair. I think that's like the dominant, like if you were to ask, you know, John Q underground player, you know, how he's going to make money, he's like, I play tricky hands, then I make two pair, then I get all their money because they never fold overpairs. Like, I really think that a lot of people don't fold overpairs, do fold overpairs, and indeed they think that not folding overpairs is a mistake. Right. Moreover, there are some who don't. There are some who really will not do that. But the thing is that the same sort of person who never folds an overpair is the sort of person who gets into situations where he should have an overpair better with much less than that. So if he won't fold an overpair, maybe he will fold second pair. And frankly, he probably will take more heat with a second pair than he should. So even there, it's only relevant that somebody won't fold an overpair if that's most of his range or all of his range. So, there's an inconsistency. Like, oh, I would never bluff him. He can't fold an overpair. Well, he can't fold an overpair on the river, but he can fold top pair eighth kicker on the turn. Are you sure? those are sometimes correlated. Those are often correlated.
Yeah, I was about to say something else about that. Now I'm forgetting what it was. Well, it couldn't have been too important.
Yeah, you were probably just agreeing with me because it was so smart.
It was very smart.
We got one more hand today.
We do, and this one is a proper hand. It's coming to us from Art. Art says, this hand came up during event 3 of the $40,000 guarantee, $200 buy-in deep stack event at the Bike. This is a level 2 hand, so blinds are 150-300. And Art had run the starting stack of 15K up to 28K. A player from middle position had one limper ahead of him and raised to 750. He just got to the table and had not played an orbit yet. This was his first hand. One person called, and our hero was on the button holding 7 of hearts, 8 of diamonds. So first question is, what would you do here? Basically, the action is limp, raise to 750, call, and you're on the button with 7 hearts, 8 of diamonds. You have 28K. We don't know the stacks of the other players, but it's only level 2, so I think it's a safe to assume probably they have over 10K and maybe closer to 15K.
I think it's close. So the first thing to notice is how small this raise is. A 2.5 x-raise over a limper, that's pretty small. I would probably be more tempted to 3-bet than to call. So calling 750 off a 28K stack, that's, you know, you leave yourself a lot of money behind. And I think that unsuited connectors can be a slightly underrated hand. I think in position they play quite well after the flop. I think that folding would be my first instinct, though, nonetheless. And I would be very tempted to 3-bet. Like I understand that a lot of modern players have balanced small raising ranges, but boy, somebody who just shows up to the table and then makes it 750 over a limper, I think if I made it 2100, I would get all folds plenty of times. And if not, you know, as I said, 8-7 plays okay after the flop. That's a tempting option. I think it's a little bit too light just to call, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. I think in a cash game, I would call 2.5 big blinds with this hand off the same size stack. Yeah, I think it's close. I would lean toward fold. I don't mind the call, though. What do you think?
So I think you're right that there's likely a major sizing tell here. Just even good players, there's just not that much incentive to only raise the 750 if you have aces. You know, there's a limp to 300. It's just very likely that limper is not planning on folding if you make it like 900. Like, most people aren't going to limp in for 300 and then fold for 600 more. So if you have a hand that you want to play a big pot with, or that you would like to put more money into the pot with pre-flop, like, you could easily do that. It's not going to look weird. Nobody's going to say like, oh, what a big raise, he must have aces. Like, it's in no way is it going to telegraph your hand. The guy will almost certainly call it. There's just not a lot of reason not to make a bigger raise here if you actually have a nutted hand. So, I mean, I think this is a pretty reliable sizing tell. And so my first thought here is going to be like, it might even be profitable to just squeeze any two cards. You know, I think the player who flatted is very unlikely to be flatting a big hand there. I mean, there's a chance the limper limped a big hand. I might raise a little bit more than you suggested. I would be kind of tempted to make it like 2750 or 2800. But so my first thought is that like raising here will be better than folding possibly with any hand, certainly with any like remotely playable hand. So I think the question for me, I would bring this down to a raise or call decision. And which of those I chose to undertake, you know, it would kind of be a question of like, does my hand play so well as a call that I think I can make even more money calling with it than I can raising with it? So I could see myself just calling here with like pocket sixes or 4-3 suited. I think this hand, you know, given that it doesn't play that great as a call anyway, I agree it might be a little bit underrated. But I think like given that it would be if you weren't allowed to raise here, you didn't think raising was going to be good, that you would consider it pretty close between folding or calling. That makes me think there's not really a lot of value in calling, and therefore I like by choosing to raise, I'm not sacrificing a lot of potential calling value. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So yeah, I think I would raise here, and I don't think it's necessarily a disaster that our hero didn't, but I do think it's kind of a meta disaster that a lot of people don't consider it. They're just sort of like, well, you know, I can call. So I do. I think a lot of people like rarely consider the aggressive option if they have a hand like this, and I think that is a mistake. And even if it doesn't cost you a lot in this instance, I think there are many instances where it does. Just that general mindset of defaulting towards checking or calling rather than betting or raising when you have a sort of marginal, whatever definition of marginal, you know, a hand, just like a hand that it's like you think your decisions are sort of close or whatever. I think not considering raising in those instances over time, I mean, it sometimes leads to big mistakes and ultimately just sort of leads to compounding mistakes.
I agree. I also want to say that when I said 2100, I'd overlooked the fact that there was a caller. So,
I agree. 2100 is good without a caller in there.
Yeah. Good.
Okay. So that's enough on the preflop decision. As it happens, our hero does call, both of the blinds call, and so does the original limper. So six players go to the flop with our hero holding seven of hearts, eight of diamonds. There is 4,500 in the pot. The flop comes Jack 10-3 rainbow, giving our hero the low end of a gut shot. checks to the original raiser, and he bets 800. Folds around to the button, which is the hero, and he says, I look to my left, and the two people in the blind seem to have no interest in the pot. I know that the original raiser is just making a weak attempt at a continuation bet, and he is not comfortable at all with his hand displaying classic signs of weakness. The strongest he could be, I think, is a hand like ace-10 or an underpair to the board, or perhaps he whiffed with something like ace-queen or king-queen. I just tried to rip the pot away from him, so I raised to 2200, and it folds back to the villain. He painfully calls, and it's heads up to the turn. First off, I want to applaud Art on both his attentiveness and also on having that killer instinct that I was just criticizing some people for not having a moment ago. So clearly, you know, at least in this case, he is considering the aggressive option, which I think is, as I said, is very good. And I also want to applaud him for his attentiveness on, you know, looking, both noticing the signs of discomfort on the part of his opponent and also looking to verify that the blinds did not seem particularly interested in the pot. What do you think about raising here generally and also the hero's particular raise size?
So I think raising is a good thing to be thinking about, and I want to second everything you said about congratulating Art for being attentive. I do have some questions about the interpretation of what he saw. People get very uncomfortable in six-way pots when it comes Jack-10-3 rainbow because it's not so easy to beat five opponents, and especially opponents who have hands that they don't three-bet. So a lot of people are going to have Jack-10, pocket-threes, or even pocket-tens or pocket-jacks in their calling ranges or their limp calling ranges or their cold calling ranges. And even if he has ace-jack, Queen Jack, King Jack, a lot of hands like that, I think there's a pretty good chance that he would feel uncomfortable and that he would sort of bet because he thinks he's obliged to do so. Even a hand like King Queen, maybe he doesn't want to put a ton of money in the pot with. So I think that it's great to think that it's significant that he looks uncomfortable. I question the interpretation of what he saw. So I'm not so sure that he has nothing here. That said, when he has a little bit, why not run a multi-street bluff? That's just fine. That's good. I think 2200. I think that'll be good at knocking him off a hand like ace-10, exactly, or king-10 or pocket sevens. I think that's a great play against those hands. I'm not sure it'll fold out a jack or an overpair or a straight draw or maybe even a hand like ace-king or ace-queen. So I think how good this raise size is depends on the plan you have. If it's going to be a one or done bluff, I would rather bet a little bit more to give him a slightly tougher decision. If you're running a multi-street bluff, I think this tells a fine story. I think pretending you have Jack 10, then going from there is a good way to figure out your bet sizing in this spot. Another option is to call the flop and look to get aggressive later, especially if you think that the discomfort is a weak made hand. Of course, a 9 actually makes your hand, but an 8 or 7 that pairs you will also put up will also complete some straight draws. You know, a queen could conceivably, I mean, that'll give him a straight draw some of the time, but a queen could conceivably be a bluffing card. It's you leave yourself, you know, calling the flop and getting aggressive later is another conceivable way to play this hand too.
Yeah, I think it's good, as you say, it's good to recognize that this is a good spot to consider bluffing, and I think that doesn't necessarily make it an any two cards spot. You know, just because the spot is okay for bluffing, sometimes you kind of need the contribution of your hand to turn it into a good bluff, if that makes sense. Like, it might be that your opponent will fold often enough that if you also have some equity in the pot, then you know, the combination of how often they fold plus your equity in the pot will make it profitable, but just raising with anything will not be profitable. Now, our hero doesn't quite have just anything. He does have a gut shot. I think, though, given the potential, he does mention king-queen as a hand that his opponent might have, and so the fact that we've got a gut shot to the wrong end here is relevant. So like the fact that hitting a nine both does not make you the nuts and also makes the board quite scary. So, you know, in the event that he's wrong on his read, you know, perhaps this 800 is actually coming from a hand like a set of jacks or tens that's trying to, you know, doesn't want to like scare people out of the pot. Like that's a not uncommon way of thinking. So in that case, part of the value of raising here, maybe something that offsets the cost of raising is a better way of thinking of it, is that sometimes you'll end up making a straight. And I think your ability to win a big pot with a straight is kind of hamstrung by the fact that there's going to be another straight either your opponent could have or just for your opponent to be afraid of that's possible out there. And so it might be a little difficult for you to get paid off or to put a lot of money in good when you end up making a straight. And given that that's really the only thing this hand has going for it, like hitting a seven or an eight is not very likely to be helpful to you, I might choose not to bluff with this exact hand. I might actually prefer to bluff if I had a hand like 4-3 suited where I can count five outs that are a little more likely to have implied odds attached to them if I hit them. As opposed to this hand, which is four outs, and they're outs to sort of dicey spots. Even if I hit them, I don't think there's necessarily a ton of value in that. I mean, that said, if you can do it for cheaply enough, you might as well. And you know, 2,200 is offering yourself a very good price. After the bet of 800, there's 5,300 in the pot. So I mean, if you actually have a realistic chance of winning the pot by risking only 2,200, more power to you. I'm a little concerned about the size of that bet. It strikes me as rather small relative to the pot. It's possible that your opponent will just not be very conscious of the pot size. I think that it would actually be a mistake for your opponent to fold a hand like ace 10 or king 10 here, given the odds that he's going to be getting and how easily you could have some shenanigans like ace 7 offsuit. But if he's going to, more power to him, and yeah, you certainly should pull the trigger. But my concern is that the hero might not be paying a lot of attention to the pot size generally and just sort of sizing his raise off of the opponent's bet, which I think is a pretty common thing. People just think like, well, I'll raise about three times whatever my opponent bet. And the problem with that is when your opponent bets an extremely small fraction of the pot, as happened here, your raise ends up being extremely small as well. So once you raise here, your opponent is faced with calling 1,400 more, and there's going to be 7,500 in the pot. So he's going to be getting about 5-1 on a call, and he really should not fold hands like ace queen, ace king, king queen, any 10. I mean, those are probably all hands that should be calling your small raise. So if you think he won't call with those hands, you know, great, give him a chance to make that mistake. But I am not so confident that he's going to make that mistake. The villain does in fact call. Hero says that he painfully calls. So they're heads up to the turn with 8,900 in the pot. And I think it's significant that Art did not tell us that there was 8,900 in the pot. I'm concerned that he is maybe not keeping track of this, and as a result, not sizing his bets as well as he could have. So although I think the attentiveness generally is good and the creativity is good, I just want to reiterate the importance of being conscious of the pot size and sizing your bets appropriately. The turn is a seven, which gives our hero a pair. No backdoor flush draws become possible, so I guess we're looking at still a rainbow board. The villain checks with 8,900 in the pot. What do you think Art should do now?
That's a good question. So I think if I chose this bet size on the flop, it would be to keep my foot on the gas. And I think a lot of the hands that Art has are going to have one pair in them. So if I still thought that I could try to run the villain off this hand, I would probably fire away. I would think that my seven hadn't put me in the lead, although it may have given me some more outs, at least most of the time. And I would stick a bet in there. Also, 8-9 got there. So, you know, jack 10. There are plenty of hands I can represent. And especially given the read, I think a bet would put a lot of pressure on the opponent. Moreover, I wouldn't lose the full value of the bet. We're betting with equity, which is good. And also important is that since we have equity, we need to think about how often we're going to get raised. And I think we won't get raised too often here. I think it's going to be tough, given the action for a villain to find a hand that he's going to raise us with. So
I think when he does raise, also you don't have so much equity.
Yeah, like that. Yeah.
Our hands that you're drawing pretty thin against.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think the big fear is getting raised by a good one pair hand, and I think that's probably not going to happen because the best one pair hands didn't play this way, and because the one pair of hands he has aren't going to raise. So I very much agree. Getting raised by a hand that you have good equity against is uncommon here. So I would bet plenty. You know, something like 50 to 65% of the pot ish, especially given the stacks. I think it it begins to threaten the stack. And that's a good thing to do, and I think it'll feel large in absolute terms to the villain. So yeah, I think 5,700 or so. Since we're trying to fold out a hand as good as maybe a weak top pair, I think we should make a significant bet. The number I pick is 5,700. What do you think?
I think this is one of those kind of interesting spots where sometimes, because, like, if your range was too wide on a previous street, as you know, I think maybe it might be here. I mean, maybe there's good exploitive reasons for it, but you know, regardless, sometimes you you play a hand that you probably should not have played on the previous street, and as a result of that, like, it ends up being the bottom of your range on the next street, and so you kind of have to bluff with it at that point, or like it becomes one of your better bluffing candidates because like it's really a weaker hand than you ought to have anyway. And so I think that's the case here. I think the seven, as you say, is a pretty good card for Hero in the sense that it creates some threats that he can represent. It legitimately improves his hand a little bit relative to some of his bluff targets and gives him a few outs. So I think this is a better, like, our hand now is a hand that a little more clearly belongs in a bluffing range, I think, than what it was on the flop. And so I definitely like the idea of firing at this point. I think you're right in terms of the sizing. I guess parallel to my concern about Art not telling us the size of the pot is we know his stack, we don't know his opponent's stack, and that's certainly an important thing to keep in mind generally, but definitely when the pot is getting this big, where you know there's potential that if the opponent does have roughly a 15K starting stack, we're probably in a position now where half pot now and half pot on the river will put that player all in, or pretty close to all in. Maybe so. I think we might want to think about betting a bet size that would enable us to bet a similar fraction of the pot and make that an all in bet on the river. And I think we may want to pull that trigger somewhat frequently, especially if we use slightly smaller sizing on the turn. So if we were to bet, say, 40% pot on the turn and then jam maybe about half the deck on the river, I think cards bigger than a 10 are pretty bad for you, given what we think villain's continuing range might be. There's a lot of ways that those cards are either going to make him trips or make him a straight or make him two pair or something. But I think cards that come small, like I guess a 7 is pretty good for you. So really, it's not half the deck. It's like deuces through sixes, I suppose, will be pretty good jamming cards as a bluff on the river. It might actually be kind of hard to jam like a 7 or 8 for value on the river because your hand will be kind of overrepresented at that point. Yeah. But yeah, I think about half the deck is good for you. Either it improves your hand or it will set up a good shove for you on the river. So yeah, I definitely want to bet something here on the turn, and I think you're in the right neighborhood in terms of sizing, Nate.
Good. Art bets 3,500. Little small?
A little small. Not horrid. As long as we're still talking about 15K stacks. If the villain also has 28K, then I would say it is a pretty significant mistake, because we really want to be in a spot where we have the option to threaten his stack on the river. And of course, if we had a very big hand, you know, if we did actually turn a straight, we'd want to be in a spot where we could put stacks in on the river for value. So I think that, you know, as long as this is still a bet that enables you to threaten his stack on the river, I think it's okay. My inclination would be to bet at least a little bit more.
Yeah.
With 15,900 in the pot, we go to the river, which is a 9. So final board is Jack 10, 3, 7, 9. Our hero is holding 8-7. So he has got Jack 10, 9, 7 on the board. He's holding an 8, so he's got a straight, but it is not the nuts. Villain's mood quickly changes, and he bets out 3,500, making sure that he uses the exact same chips that I used. I wanted to fold. King-Queen came in, but I convinced myself he could easily be doing this with 10-9 or Jack-9, and I also figured that the pot was too big to fold with the worst straight, so I did end up calling. 15,900 in the pot, you're facing a bet of 3,500. I don't really see an option other than calling, do you?
Every time, especially in these tournaments. Boy, you see goofy stuff. A lot of people love to block bet.
These tournaments.
Yeah, I mean, tournaments like this.
No, I know. It's just funny.
And it's also like it's not 2005 anymore. It's just not. People know how to block bet, even poor opponents, through sort of quasi-evolutionary procedures. Like, a lot of them are capable of having a lot of hands in this spot.
And this is actually a good spot to block bet. Like, I'm not a big proponent of block betting. I'm starting to get a little bit more sold on it, but this is a legitimately good spot to do it with some of the hands that Dylan mentions.
Yeah, I agree. I think, although King-Queen was one of the hands I mentioned on the flop, I think that a lot of opponents won't feel so uncomfortable on the flop. I certainly wouldn't with a good nutting hand like that in a six-way pot.
I'm excited. I would almost, in fact, I think I'd rather have King-Queen there, certainly, than like Ace-10.
Sure.
Maybe even more so than Ace-Jack.
Sure. I mean, or like, King-Queen, I mean, pocket-queens has blockers, and it's also a great hand, but like, no. I mean, King-Queen is a great hand, and I'm real happy about it. Especially at this depth, like, you're going to be able to bet 3-bet and get fold equity a lot. It's fantastic. So I think he'll have an 8 sometimes. I also think a hand like Jack-7 suited, like, I think he could be blocking you with an 8 or without an 8. You know, 2-bad pair. Medium 2-pair, fine 1-pair. I think a hand like Ace-Jack is not impossible. No, I would not fold. I think not raising is good. I think another thing to applaud Art for is being able to look beyond the fact that he has a straight, recognizing the relative and not just the absolute value of his hand, and not raising. I think that was good. Folding would be, I think, very poor.
I just want to reiterate the point about not raising here. I think sometimes there's a mentality of like, well, what did I play the hand for if I'm not going to raise when I get there? And I mean, I do think that like maybe it's a reason not to raise with this hand in the first place, as I mentioned, that like you can't feel that comfortable when a 9 gets there. But you know, given that you did play it, like you can't feel that comfortable when a 9 gets there.
Yeah.
Especially when there's only a 1 card straight on the board. Like, it's a little different if the board is just Jack 10 9. Your opponent has a little more incentive to pay you off without a straight if you raise because you have a 2 card straight. But when, you know, it's plain as day, anyone can see that if you have a 6, you have a straight. It's kind of hard to get paid off. Or sorry, if you have an 8, you have a straight. It's kind of hard to get paid off by second best hands when like you have the worst possible straight and other than stronger ones are possible.
Yeah, I agree.
So results, Art ended up losing to King Queen, which, I mean, actually, that's another reason to bet the turn. Like, not only, there's actually a chance that Art has the best hand on the turn. We should have talked about that. And, you know, there is some actual protection / value interest in betting the turn. I think that by itself, you know, if you knew your opponent were never going to fold, you wouldn't be able to bet for that reason alone. But it definitely improves your equity when called that there are some worse hands in your opponent's calling range.
Yeah, so if the river had come a 3, it probably would have gone check, bet, fold. Or even check with Art winning, which is good. This opponent doesn't seem like the type who would have run Art off a 7, so very good.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be proud of here, and the most important thing is that I call it the killer instinct. What I was talking about before the flop that Art did kind of demonstrate after the flop of just like not saying, oh, I have a weak hand, I'll either call or fold, but you're considering whether or not you can win this pot, paying attention to villain showing us signs of weakness, paying attention to the blinds also indicating that they're probably weak. There might be a little bit of refining to do here in terms of deciding, even once you see that sign of weakness, like, is this exactly the hand that I want to pull that trigger with? And then deciding what exactly is the best way of doing this. I actually, if I plug Tournament Poker Edge one more time, I have a series on bluffing on Tournament Poker Edge that kind of walks through what I think is a good thought process for running a multi-street bluff, and the most important part is identifying that it's a good spot to bluff in the first place, or being able to assess how good of a spot it is. And so I think that's kind of the hardest thing to do and the most important thing to get right. And I think that maybe it's not the hardest thing to do, but it is the most important thing to get right. And I think that Art got that part right. I think that, you know, the bet of 800 into 5300 on the flop certainly should, or sorry, into 4500 on the flop certainly should invite you to have a healthy bluffing range. And then where exactly you go with that from there is, you know, there's a lot of skill involved in determining what exactly should that bluffing range consist of and how exactly are you going to execute that bluff, you know, there's a whole set of skills that go into figuring that out. And you know, hopefully we were able to help you and help Art along a little bit with that part. But I think just you know, recognizing and being willing to pull the trigger in the first place, I think that was very good. And I think on the river, you know, I understand the discomfort. I can see if villain were to bet something like 60 or 70% pot, I would probably want to fold. But I think when you're getting odds that good, I mean, you're supposed to call and lose pretty often when you're getting those kind of odds. Yeah. Like if you're not calling and losing there, then you're folding the best hand too often. You know, like you do lose money when you fold the best hand. Sometimes it doesn't feel that way because you're thinking like, well, I didn't lose anything. I lost zero. I folded. But you know, you lost your equity in the pot. So like when you're getting odds like that, calling and losing a lot is correct. And if you aren't calling and losing a lot when you're getting great odds on the river, then that indicates that you're doing something wrong in your game.
Yeah, and especially given that when you don't lose, you get half. Like, people don't like to call to get half the pot. But in the case when you call and get half the pot, you put 3,500 in and then get half of 16 like plus back. 7. Yeah, no, more than that. The 16K in the pot going to the river.
Right, 8,000 plus your 35.
Yeah. So you make almost three times your money. like you get like a 200% return on your money almost when you get half the pot, and that's good. So yeah, definitely on your river call, I mean. So I would not fold. But thanks for writing in Art. We've gotten this on Twitter a little bit more, so I think I need to spiel this more often. If you have a hand or anything else you would like us to discuss, possibly at great length on the podcast, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. That's podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.